Welcome to In My Backyard, an open conversation about children and mental health. We all know a child who's struggling, whether that child tells us or not. In this podcast, we speak with experts on the many factors of emotional distress in children, how to address those factors, and how to create a community where all children can be healthy and happy. This podcast is made possible through generous donations from supporters and listeners like you. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Your host is Tricia Costales, CEO of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California.
I'm Tricia Costales, your host of In My Backyard. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and the chief executive officer of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency serving 3,500 children and families every year. We spoke in prior episodes about the prevalence of psychological distress amongst our children and the impact that the COVID pandemic is having on emotional well-being. Today, we're going to talk about the impact of another kind of pandemic on our children, the pandemic of systemic and institutionalized racism against people of color. The mental health system has long recognized that chronic stress has a negative impact on mental health, but until recently, the assessment of what constitutes stress had a notable white middle-class bias. It's only relatively recently that trauma and chronic stress are defined more broadly to include societal elements such as poverty, community violence, and racism and discrimination. As written in a 2019 abstract by Dr. David Williams of the Harvard Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences, there's a large body of high-quality scientific evidence that documents the persistence of racial discrimination in employment, housing, banking, and other commercial transactions, and in a broad range of domains of everyday life. The discrimination experienced by people of color includes acute major life stressors, such as police profiling, as well as what we might call everyday discrimination. That might be someone crossing the street to avoid a man of color, losing a cell phone and assuming a young black boy took it, or questioning why a family of color is walking in a certain neighborhood away from their kind. More recent studies demonstrate the association between experiences of racism and mental health struggles. They show that this association begins in childhood, leading to higher rates of depression, anxiety, and the behavioral disorders that are a hallmark of childhood trauma. In today's podcast, we're going to talk with Angelina Palma Williams, a licensed clinical social worker and program manager at the Guidance Center. We're fortunate to have a conversation with her about the real-life impact of racism and discrimination on our young children of color. Welcome, Angelina. Thank you for joining us today. I have the great benefit of knowing you from our shared leadership roles at the Guidance Center. For our audience, will you please share a little bit about yourself?
Yes, thank you, Tricia. I want to first thank you for inviting me to have this important conversation on racism and the impact in mental health. As you know, that this is a topic I've really been focused on a lot and dedicating a lot of my energy towards. So I'm humbled to have this platform with you today. As you mentioned, I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I've been working in the mental health field for a little over 15 years, specifically in community mental health. And the majority of my work has been with school-age children and their families in Black and Brown communities. And I just want to also share, I also identify as a Black woman, as a wife, and as a mother.
Thank you. You know, Angelina, growing up, I had, I think, a relatively unique experience of having parents who spoke to us about the wrongs of racism. We had conversations over dinner, they showed us movies and books on the topic, and they actively role modeled what it means to stand up against racism when you see it in real life. Some of my very earliest memories are of my parents taking a stand against racism when they witnessed it in our community. community, even getting death threats for their efforts. They weren't radical. We were a boring middle-class family in suburban Ohio, where my Spanish origin father was the most ethnic thing in our neighborhood. I had a stay-at-home mom and an engineer dad. But in this area, my parents really got it right. Over the years, I've realized that as proud as I am of that, I have to own the element of privilege in my family's efforts. We talked about racism as a societal wrong, but from a really sort of macro, big picture perspective, we never really talked about the individual impact because it didn't impact us personally. What might it mean to grow up as a person of color in a society that just does not value you equally as your white peers? I'd like to take some time now to explore the personal impact of racism on a person.
Trisha, I really appreciate the perspective that you share in reflection of your upbringing, because I think that provides really a beautiful illustration of how complex racism is. I mean, it isn't just about history and systems and how they work. And it's not just about hurtful words and behaviors towards others. It's really all of that, all at the same time. You know, because racism is so ingrained in the fabric of our society and the systems, and that has to be acknowledged. And I think we have to discuss this and really figure out how to dismantle it. And at the same time, racism cuts really deep. I mean, to the core of the individuals that are being impacted by racism. I mean, there are lots of opinions about racism, right? Like, you know, is the impact of institutional racism really valid because there's been so much progress? And I mean, I kind of do like air quotes when I say progress, because John Henry Clark says that if you start the story with slavery, then yeah, everything is going to look like progress. But I think that it's easier for some people to think about how impactful hurtful words are when it's like the overt hurtful behaviors from racism and bigotry. And that's easier to kind of understand and process. But I'd argue that all of that is racism. All of those are forms of racism, and they're damaging both emotionally, mentally, and physically on all of those levels. And when I think about the emotional pain from racism, what comes to mind for me is just like that sound of sorrow. You know, I think we all have kind of a representation of what sorrow looks like or feels like, whether that's like this deep emotional cry or the affect that someone carries during grief. And when we witness someone dealing with sorrow, there's no explanation needed, right? Like, we just get it from a human level that person is experiencing something so grave and so impactful for them. But I don't think that the same thing happens with racism, and understanding that experience of the human, that human being that is experiencing racism, is that deep and that hurtful. So I think that, you know, the impact on mental health, on a mental health level, is just as painful. I mean, we see it manifest in the damage of self-esteem and self-worth. And it's manifested as anxiety, depression, and other mental health conditions. I mean, we know that racism is trauma, and we know that trauma impacts the brain and how we develop. It impacts stress hormones, and other physical functions. And so all of these factors that I've mentioned, I think we have to remember to put a face to it that is not just the systematic thing that's happening. It is emotional, mental, physical damage that's happening to people, and specifically to BIPOC people, Black, Indigenous people of color, because of racism.
Thank you, Angelina. That was actually quite powerful, but some of the things that you said lead me to sort of my next question. You know, I was doing research for our conversation today, and I read that as many as a quarter of Black Americans report experiencing everyday discrimination as often as several times a week. From what we know about chronic stress, it's hard to imagine a way that this doesn't chip away at a child's self-worth and resiliency. And how does that impact mental health, and how is this reflected in the clients we see at the Guidance Center?
So as I mentioned, you know, I'm a social worker, so I kind of come from that lens of pulling from social work and sociology. So when I think about like the lived experience of a person from a sociology perspective, we would consider all aspects of the quality of that person's life, including the systems they interact with, such as their family, their friends, and schools, because this gives us like a full picture, like a comprehensive picture of what is contributing to the way that that person functions. And so for people of color, I think it's important, important aspect is that we overlook that this person is constantly engaging in institutions that are founded in or have a foundation in racism. And when I think about specifically the population that we work with, which are school-aged children, they are often engaging in the school system. And so I'm sure you've heard of research that's been done to look at how teachers interact with students, specifically students of color, and how they respond to them. And consistently, teachers identify the behaviors of Black children as more delinquent than their peers. And because of that, what we see is that Black children are called on more for correction, they're sent to the office more, and their behaviors are identified as aggressive or, you know, all these other negative ways of characterizing them. So just imagine for that child a daily experience of being called on and picked on for things that they don't really have any control over. Their skin or their culture that they identify with is something that they can't control, but yet they're being impacted by how someone else perceives them because of that. And also because of that, what happens or what we start to see, especially the clients that we treat at the Guidance Center, is that they start to accept that narrative as a truth for themselves. And some of those characteristics that have been placed on them, they start to accept as truths. So we see an impact in their self-esteem and in their behaviors as they start to kind of play out what has been assigned to them as a person. So I think not only are we seeing that as an acceptance of their identity and their self-worth is changing, but then we also see the development of anxiety and depression and behavior symptoms that they're manifesting while they're, you know, at school. So really circling back, I know I've said a lot, but like circling back, I can't say this enough, discrimination is racism and racism is trauma. And we're working with kids that are traumatized. And those are the kids that we see at our agency.
And who've really, what you're saying, I think, is that they've really internalized those sort of implied messages that they're getting at school. I'm bad, I'm not worthy, I'm not as smart as, I'm yes. aggressive. And that becomes part of how they identify themselves.
Yes.
And that, of course, is going to be problematic and tragic and very sad for a small child. You know, one of the things we talk all the time about as therapists is, especially of late, the detrimental impact that trauma has on a developing child's ability to attend to their age-appropriate developmental tasks. A traumatized child's brain spends too much time in a vigilant state, so it doesn't have time or energy to focus on those other higher level tasks. I've been thinking a lot lately about what that means as it relates to racism and discrimination. So can we talk a little bit about that, the sort of hypervigilance that comes from that daily experience of sort of everyday discrimination? How does that impact a child's ability to attend to their other tasks, to their well-being?
So yes, I think you're already speaking to what how I want to respond to that our brains are programmed to protect us. I mean, we're really hardwired to take in information quickly and to make a decision about what we're experiencing. And I can't say this enough that, you know, racism is trauma. So, you know, without trauma, our brain can have access to our higher level thinking. We can critically think, we can plan, we can problem solve. But when we have trauma from discrimination or racism, then that process is interrupted and the development of the executive functioning is interrupted. So for protection and survival, we create these shortcuts. Our brain just kind of allows like the brainstem, I don't know if I'm getting into the weeds with that, but like to take over. And a survival shortcut that is made is that we might flip our lids. We might, kind of access that or go into that fight, flight, or freeze response, which looks like tantrums. That looks like, you know, being more argumentative or physically aggressive. We might also see somatic symptoms, avoidance, isolation, but that's all happening because of that hypervigilance from stress, from trauma, from racism. And so when we see these behaviors in children, I think I try to remind myself and I recognize that it's a trauma response. These are trauma symptoms that the child is exhibiting. And there's just a saying that a question I always ask myself when I see these behaviors of hypervigilance is, you know, making meaning of those behaviors and asking what has happened to this child instead of what's wrong with this child. And I think too quickly we go into what's wrong with this child. Like there's something innately bad about that person or that child. But instead, I think if we ask that question of what happened, it'll lead us to think about the experiences of the child and to really tap in to look at maybe there are these experiences of discrimination that's contributing to the behaviors that we're seeing in children and their well-being.
I think that I love that line that you just said, that what happened to this child, not what's wrong with this child. That's such a simple sentence, but it's such an important shift in thinking. I really like that. But, you know, as you're talking, I'm a parent. I'm a single parent of twin boys. I look at it from a parental lens as well. So here we have parents of color, perhaps, who've had their own experiences of trauma related to their experiences of racism and discrimination. And then the worry when your child leaves the house. I remember I had a client once many years ago. It was an African-American mom and her son. And I found that she had been disciplining him with a belt. And I was required to make a child abuse report by my mandate. And as we were discussing it, she told me something that stuck with me. She said, "You will never understand." She said, "If my child misbehaves, he could be killed. If my child misbehaves, he's going to be kicked out of school. He's going to be shot. The police are going to take him. My child can't misbehave. Your child doesn't have that same pressure put on him." And I never forgot that. So I want to talk too about the parents. What's that mental health toll on them? They have their own traumatic experiences and they're raising a child knowing the danger that child might be facing.
Are you familiar with a psychologist by the name of Dr. Joy DeGruy?
I'm familiar but not on any deep dive level. So tell me.
Yes. So she is a renowned psychologist and she's also an author of a book called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. And in her book, she talks about the residual impact of generational slavery and racism. And also she talks about the impact on parenting in the Black community. And she connects the devastating experiences during slavery where families were ripped apart and sold for property. And she ties that into the discrimination during Jim Crow, as well as racism that we still see today. And what she explains is that because of those experiences, Black parents have understood that this world does not belong to them. And because of that understanding, it creates a fear within Black parents that, just like the woman that you shared about, understanding that if I don't protect my child, or if I don't teach or correct my child in a certain way, then I have to be fearful that someone outside of my family, outside of my control, will then harm my child. And right. That is
someone who doesn't love him will
someone
then take
that doesn't love
that control.
Exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, she really goes in depth in her book to really explain this concept and how it impacts on both parenting level and just within the community as a whole. But I think for me to really respond to your question, I have to just use my own personal experience as a parent. And I mentioned earlier, I'm a mother, I have a 10-year-old son. And I mean, I really genuinely worry about him every day. He's only 10, but I worry about him. I mean, he attends a primarily white school in a really good school district. And I worry about how people will perceive him just because of the way that he looks. And I've gone so far because of that fear and that worry that my husband and I, every single year, we've written a letter to his school, to his teacher in the beginning of the school year. And we, our hope is to send a message about who our son is. We talk about how honest he is and kind and intelligent. And he's just like really this social kid because he's the only child and he wants to interact. And we don't want his need for that social engagement to be misinterpreted. And I think why we do that is we're hoping to neutralize the impact of any implicit bias that they might have about our son just because he's a Black boy. But I mean, that's something we try to do, but then we also worry about his first direct experience with racism. And we worry about if we prepared him for that experience. And I mean, we've had to have tough conversations with him about racism and how people are going to perceive him. And the hardest thing was seeing kind of that innocence kind of melt away from his face as we're explaining that people look at him and think about him in a certain way just because of the way that he looks. I think the hardest part about all of it is just this weight of helplessness. I mean, as parents, we all worry about our kids. We worry about, are we going to impact their development? Are they happy? Are they going to be healthy? But I think just speaking from my perspective and my experience, I have like this added worry that I brought my son into this world and I can't fully protect him from people that might hurt him just because of their beliefs. And that's just overwhelming to think that I could do everything right. You know, we could educate him. We can teach him how to behave and help him grow to be this awesome kid. We could do that all right. And still, I know he's going to experience racism. I know that that's going to happen. And that hurts. That's overwhelming.
Accepting the emotional, behavioral, and psychiatric toll that racism and lived discrimination have on young children of color leads to important conversations about the experiences of those children as they enter the mental health systems that are there to help them. Mental health providers are not exempt from the implicit biases of the general population. We know, for example, that Black men are more likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia than white men with the same symptoms, who are more commonly given a diagnosis of depression or anxiety. A Black child is more likely to be given the more pejorative diagnosis of conduct disorder or oppositional defiant disorder, rather than the diagnoses of depression or anxiety assigned to their white peers with the same symptoms. That same Black child is also more likely to be referred to the juvenile justice system rather than to specialized mental health treatment. Globally, as a system of care, we look to an emotionally and behaviorally troubled white child and see the sadness, grief, and trauma behind the behaviors that brought them to our doors. When we look at an equally troubled Black child, we just see the behaviors and label them a bad kid. So, this conversation about sort of the bias and how people who aren't people of color can never fully understand, it does lead us into questions about sort of implicit biases. And when we talk about mental health in that regard, I do believe that the majority of people who choose to be a clinician, especially in the kind of setting where we work in a community-based setting, they do so because they genuinely want to help people. So how do we account for these discrepancies in treatment within the mental health system based on the color of your skin?
So I would say my short answer is structural racism and implicit bias. I mean, you mentioned implicit bias. That's my short answer. I mean, we know that the foundation of mental health is from a Eurocentric male perspective. Both theory and diagnostic criteria was developed without this cultural competency and humility in mind that, you know, we focus on now, but when it was developed, that wasn't a part of it. And so in addition to that, I think also I agree with you that I believe that most individuals choose to do this work because they want to promote healing. However, I think that we're all a product of our environment. I mean, we have direct experiences or our exposure through media or just a greater society that all influences our lens and our perspective. So, I mean, implicit bias is this buzzword right now, but I love that it is because it really helps us to understand that because we all have brains and we're all human, start there, and we all have brains that we're programmed, we're programmed to do kind of this like quick sorting and like what's the in-group and what's out-group and what's safe and what's unsafe. And that's all influenced by our experiences. So this happens without our knowledge, and it usually runs opposite to what our conscious, like egalitarian beliefs are. So yeah, we have these people that want to do good and they want to heal. But if someone doesn't have that awareness and recognize that their beliefs about people or groups of people have been impacted by this larger society, and this happens on that unconscious level, then they're likely to then treat and conceptualize the work that they're doing from that lens of lacking that awareness. I could just even think about on a very basic level, an interaction that I've seen very often where, you know, a Black parent is having an interaction with, let's say, a clinician or a supervisor, and it's an intense conversation. Both people are passionate about helping this child, right? And someone might walk away from that experience with a Black parent and say, oh, that parent was really aggressive. But then they can have a very similar conversation with a non-Black parent. And I've heard it described as, you know, that was a difficult conversation. And, you know, it's the difference in those two interactions is that with the Black parent, the situation was projected onto the Black parent as a characteristic of aggressiveness. Whereas with the non-Black parent, that situation was then conceptualized or understood as like a shared interaction between both people that was challenging. So just in that very simple interaction, we see the differences that come up because of someone's implicit bias about a person or a group of people. So I think that that contributes to the discrepancy is that lack of awareness.
But we all will always have our own worldview and our own lenses based on our lived experiences, our sort of place in the world. So how do we go about changing it? How do we clean up our own backyard and create change within the mental health system of care?
Yes. You know, we're having this conversation, so I think that we both accept and acknowledge that we need to clean up our own backyard. But I think that's the first step as a whole, is that we have to accept that our backyard needs cleaning up. You know, there's some weeds in there we need to pull. And it isn't just a problem that's over there or out of reach, but it's a problem that affects all of us every day if we choose to acknowledge that this is a shared human connection. And I think by doing this, then we can start looking at our own behaviors, our own thoughts and interactions, Because I think that this is something I constantly do. I mean, I have implicit bias, and I constantly welcome that to be brought into my conscious awareness. I do this by asking myself, you know, when a thought comes up or I say something, I ask myself, wow, where did that come from? Or why did I think or assume that? So I ask myself those things. And I believe that we also have to have more conversations like we're having right now. And we have to have those conversations with people that look differently than we do, think differently than we do, and have those different lived experiences. Because I really believe that exposure is a key to creating new associations in our brain so that, you know, those implicit biases start to shift. Because, you know, implicit bias is not always negative. We have some positive implicit bias and thoughts about groups of people. So I think the associations and the exposure will start to shift that. And I think we also have to be brave enough to make mistakes and to correct each other and be corrected. And I think that if we do all of this, then on an individual level, then it's going to translate to change as a whole in the mental health level, because we'll start to see more research and culturally affirming theory and practices in our field.
There's a huge level of vulnerability that requires in an individual, because I do believe, as you said, we all have implicit biases. We just do, because we have different life experiences and that creates those biases in us. But what a level of vulnerability to say, I'm sometimes going to blow it. I'm going to make a mistake sometimes. I need to explore this in myself constantly. I need to apologize if I feel that I erred. I need to listen without defensiveness. And we are asking for a level of vulnerability on a personal and a professional level that I think is going to be vital for us to create change. I agree with you. So that's sort of within our system of care, but how about the larger community where our clients and families live? Because we're still going to be getting these young children of color coming in, having experienced these lifetimes already of everyday discrimination. So how do we, or what's our responsibility as a community mental health system to impact the larger community?
I think it's really a collaborative process. And power also is really key. So there's a concept, critical race theory, where it's an approach where we acknowledge that in our role as practitioners, that we already have a certain level of power. I mean, even if you're a practitioner of color, you still have a certain level of power that your clients don't have. So it's really important that when we like interface and interact with clients and families within the community, that we actively shift that power dynamic in a collaborative process. And I think that starts with, you know, letting them tell us their story and not being the all-knowing and powerful, like, I know everything, I know how to help you and what you need, because that's coming from our culture and our lens and our perspective. Because I think too many times people are making decisions for and about people that lack power, and our clients have a voice and it needs to be elevated. So I think that is one way that we can do that. And also, I guess I would say exploring how we are evaluating the needs that our clients have, and being cautious about having a standard that's centered in whiteness when we're developing programs and resources for our community. And that way we can assure that we are operating from an equity lens that is asking, you know, the family and the community what they need to thrive, not what we think they need to thrive.
Could you explain what you mean by sort of program development from a standard of whiteness?
So if we think about let's talk about in Department of Children and Family Services, and we have a family that has need, because we're saying that they're neglectful, or the parenting example you gave earlier about using the bell, that from a white culture, maybe using physical discipline is not a part of the culture and not acceptable. But in many cultures, not just Black community, but in many cultures, there's different ways of disciplining, whether it's having your kids. And I'm not saying I agree with any of this necessarily, but there are approaches to disciplining your children. And if we automatically say that is wrong, you need to do it this way, because in this culture, this is the way it's done, then we're disregarding that family's culture and their perspective without having a conversation. Of course, collaboratively, we want to work towards what can we do to meet what your need is and the reason why you're doing this for your child, which is to correct a behavior. And how can we together figure out how to do that in a way that's going to be healthy and safe for your child? So I think that's what I mean, not just coming from like, this is the one way to do it.
Right. So going back to that mother example that I gave, if after I had to make the child abuse report, that's my legal mandate.
Of course.
But after that point and after my conversation with her, there are paths. I could assess she's an abusive mom. I need to tell her that's wrong and this is what she needs to do. Or I need to accept and understand that she's afraid. This is her worldview. It's a righteous and rightful worldview. She's not wrong about the fears she has for her son. So let me work with her there.
Exactly.
Instead of saying this is an abusive mom, say this is a mom of color who's really scared for her child.
Exactly.
So that's the nuance. That's the difference.
Yes, because instead of then that parent having their children removed because they're abusive and they're not capable of taking care of their child, then we're working together on how can we help you raise your child in a way that will meet the expectations you have of, or the concerns that you have as a parent, while still saying that there's value to how you feel.
Well, and there's, and the reality is, as mental health providers, we have a lot of power in how we make that report.
Yes.
The law makes us make that phone call, but we have a lot of power in terms of the words we use when we make that report.
Yes.
If I pick up and call the child abuse hotline and say, this mom is beating her son, she's abusive, that's one thing. If I pick up the phone and I say she disciplines him with a belt, I believe that it's genuinely done with discipline. She's fearful. This is why she's engaged in treatment. We're working on this. Their
yes.
response is going to be different. And that matters. That is a lot of power we have, even within the mandates of our reporting requirements.
Yes, I agree.
So, Angelina, so many challenges, and I'm glad that these conversations are more elevated now than ever before in my experience in this more nuanced level, but there's so many challenges going forward. Are there unexpected bright sides that you see right now? What still gives you hope?
I think the fact that we're still talking about this, like you just said, that these conversations weren't happening in this way. And when I think about, you know, my parents' generation, when I tell them about the things that I'm doing at work and the things that I'm involved in, they are in awe that my job is letting me, you know, have this platform. And so I think that is a part of what gives me hope, is that we're still having this dialogue and action that goes along with it. Because I think, you know, normally when something happens, there's a movement, but it quickly subsides and it's like, oh, okay, that was last month. But this is different. And I don't feel like we're getting bored with this topic and we're really, really moving towards progress. Because, you know, we have to understand, like, we're not going to quickly fix racism. In treatment, or when I was seeing clients and I would talk to parents that wanted this quick fix for their child, I'd often talk about how it took time for these behaviors to develop. And so it's going to take time for us to resolve them and to provide intervention to fix it. And so racism and trauma from racism requires that long-term treatment, just like sometimes our clients need that long-term treatment to really address those behaviors. So we can't stop talking about race and racism. We can't stop working towards change until we're healed individually and as a society.
Well, I think that, Angelina, you have a very powerful voice, and I think you did a truly remarkable job for us today, helping to really explore this issue. I actually feel quite humbled listening to you, so I thank you for that.
Thank you for having me, Tricia. This has been a great dialogue with you today. And again, I'm excited to continue to hear this conversation in other spaces. So again, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Angelina. What we've highlighted today is the often unspoken impact that lived racism and discrimination have on the mental health and emotional well-being of young children of color. We've also talked about how implicit bias and unexplored prejudices impact the care that these children receive when they reach out for help. My hope is that we all gain some insight, even if simply a greater understanding of what these children endure and how our own worldviews influence our response to it. Through advocacy, conversation, and painful self-exploration, I believe we can create change. It's my position that by shining a light on these issues, admitting that they are in our own backyards, it will be easier for a struggling child to get some help. Ideally, we can all begin to be kinder and more supportive of each other.
In My Backyard is brought to you by the Guidance Center, a children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California. In My Backyard is produced by Tricia Costales and Matthew Murray. Production assistance provided by Julie Ruano. Thank you to J. Vincent B. for original music. All other music licensed through Soundstripe. Thank you to our listeners and supporters. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Subscribe to In My Backyard on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.